From the city of Dubai, I'm Suzette Gorlock, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I have moved from one amazing country to another this week and discuss our impressions of and experiences in the glamorous city of Dubai.
On the one hand, all this progress has in many ways come on the backs of many workers, and there are some questions about how these workers are treated, particularly from South Asia.
And later, I'll talk with former Iranian hostage John Limbert. He told me he would love to take his family back to Tehran, but says he's not welcome in the Islamic Republic.
I think I remind them of a chapter in their past they would probably like to bury, and I wouldn't let them do that.
We'll mark Monday's anniversary of the end of the hostage crisis. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlock. Rebecca Cruz, we've gone from one amazing country to another. We're now here in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And again, just an amazing feeling. As soon as you hit the ground here, everything is brand spanking new, sparkly, shiny, so much wealth, so much excitement going on in this city. How do we understand it?
Well, I think my first impression was bigger, better, best. This country has spent the last couple of decades trying to make the biggest things, the biggest hotel, the biggest building, tallest building. We went to a couple of malls today, saw indoor skiing. There's an island that's been created to look like a palm tree. It's a country that's really been trying to really outdo itself. And even just 2 weeks ago, they had the biggest display of fireworks. So lots of progress, although we are seeing some interesting contradictions here as well. On the one hand, all this progress has in many ways come on the backs of many workers, and there are some question about how these workers are treated, particularly from South Asia. And then lying lower than that, of course, we're dealing with some additional strange contradictions, just as we saw in China. There seems to be this undercurrent. You know, this is a country that in many ways looks very, very liberal. But when you dig a little bit deeper or start looking a little deeper, the conservative nature still is there, very much there.
Well, we've experienced that ourselves, actually, today. A little bit of harassment, police harassment for our driver as we were pulled over, leaving a mall, and the driver, given a hard time, apparently was an illegal driver. I mean, they have a lot of controls on employment, on who you can work for, what exactly where you know the workers can go. It's actually quite invisible. I mean, all you see are tourists. I think one of the things that's really stuck out for me here is the diversity, tremendous diverse population here. Everyone coexisting. You see all these people from Saudi and other parts of the Middle East, you know, women in full cover, head to toe. And then you see, you know, women from Russia and you know, families from all other parts of the world, tons of Chinese here. And they're all coexisting. They're all shopping together. But you don't see the workers. You don't see those, as you mentioned, those from South Asia that are living, you know, outside of the city in rather poor conditions. You don't see the workers that are building this wonderful, amazing city. But you're right. I mean, there are other things going on. Recently, what was it, the American that was put in jail for a video?
Yeah, just this last week, an American citizen was finally released. He'd been apprehended about 6 or 7 months ago for a video, a parody video that he'd put on online that was not all that favorable to the country, and the government saw that and arrested him. And a year ago, there was a case of a Norwegian woman, a tourist who was here, that made a report of rape. And she, in fact, was then arrested for using alcohol. This is something else that's very interesting, that technically you're supposed to get a license to drink alcohol. Now, most people don't really do this when they come to the country, and it isn't a big deal if you're within certain bounds, within certain hotels. But the minute that you get out of a hotel and are acting drunk or belligerent and a police officer happens to see you, then they can charge you with the alcoholism. So there are some very strange laws, and there is some discretion in how these are interpreted, for sure.
Well, you mentioned the American that was just recently released. I mean, he spent 9 months in jail here for making a funny video, kind of making fun of the country. And then you mentioned earlier the conservative nature of the country and the fact that, say, movies, American movies that have a lot of violence and particularly, you know, explicit content and language. I mean, we've been seen it on TV, how they edit a lot of that out. The Wolf of Wall Street, right, was in the news recently, is that they cut out like 40 minutes of the movie. So it's a very interesting kind of dynamic here, something you really, quite frankly, don't see anywhere else in the world, where it seems very cosmopolitan and new and shiny, and yet underneath it all, there's something else still going on there.
Yeah, and I think it's particularly interesting to us. We're social scientists. We want to be able to explain this, but it really is very, very difficult to explain. It's contradiction upon contradiction, which in so many ways makes it very, very fascinating, too.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, we're here to visit universities. I mean, higher education is something that that everybody needs around the world, everybody wants around the world. And here in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, the two main cities in the UAE, are no exception. And so you see lots of universities cropping up here, a lot of private universities, a lot of American universities that have a presence here. And so so that's kind of an interesting mix, too. You have, you know, high tech, international business, and higher education all going on. And it's, you know, the incredible wealth. I mean, everything you see here, it's just really, truly amazing.
Well, and one final thing is they are already preparing for Expo 2020, and they've been preparing for that. We've seen billboards everywhere. They've been awarded that, and they're very, very excited. So the world will hopefully come and get to experience UAE in 2020.
Everybody needs to experience this amazing country. All right. Thank you so much, Rebecca Cruz. Next week, we're back at home in Norman. See you then.
Thank you.
If you have a question for me or Rebecca, let us know in the Worldview section of our website. You can also follow this show on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or contact us directly at Suzette Grelot and at Cruz226. Coming up, I'll talk with Ambassador John Limbert. In 1979, he was a State Department political officer at the U.S. Embassy in Iran when students stormed the embassy and took him and 51 colleagues hostage. Monday marks the 33rd anniversary of their release. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest, Ambassador John Limbert, spent a long career in the Foreign Service and the upper levels of the U.S. State Department. In the early 2000s, he represented the United States in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania, and later served as the first Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, focusing solely on Iranian affairs. He stepped down in 2010, frustrated that more progress wasn't made repairing U.S.-Iranian relations. On November 4, 1979, he was working as a political officer in Tehran when the U.S. Embassy was stormed by students.
The U.S. Embassy in Tehran remains occupied by Iranian students demanding extradition of the Shah and a total break in relations with America. Although as many as 100 people are being held hostage, the State Department says there's no reason to panic.
From what we have gathered, this demonstration is peaceful. And the fact that the demonstrators themselves had described this as a sit-in.
The demonstration wasn't peaceful for long, and the 52 Americans were held for 444 days. In April 1980, President Carter launched an unsuccessful rescue attempt, and in an address to the nation, he appealed to the Iranian captors to continue using restraint.
The mission on which they were embarked was a humanitarian mission. It was not directed against Iran. It was not directed against the people of Iran. It was not undertaken with any feeling of hostility toward Iran or its people.
The failure to bring the hostages home was a key issue in the 1980 U.S. presidential election, and as the Marine Band played during Ronald Reagan's inauguration, the hostages' 14-month ordeal came to an end.
For those of you just joining us, there is confirmation from the major wire services now that the American hostages are indeed aboard Algerian planes that have taken them from Tehran.
Ambassador John Limbert, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you, Suzette. It's nice to be here.
Take us back to that day, 33 years ago, when you were released and this incredible ordeal that you experienced. What was that like on that day?
Okay. We're talking about January 20th, 1981. It was the last day of President Jimmy Carter's administration. It was the day on which Ronald Reagan was sworn into office. We had been held since November 4th, 1979, so 14 months. When the original attack came, our priority was keeping everybody safe with the assumption that within a matter of hours or at most one day, those in authority would step in And exercise adult supervision over the situation and resolve it. Now, we might end up have stayed in Iran as diplomats. We might have left Iran under those circumstances. But what I think very few people foresaw was that this thing would change from a 1970-style student sit-in to a full-blown international crisis that would end up costing Jimmy Carter his presidency and casting a shadow over U.S.-Iran relations for the next 34 years.
So this experience that you had, I can't imagine. How did you and your colleagues endure? I mean, what did you do? Did you know what was going on in the outside world? Did you know about the rescue attempt?
We had no contact with the outside world. We had no news. We had no access to radio. We had no access to newspapers. Our mail was very limited, strictly controlled. We had very limited communication with each other. We would try to spread news. But for whatever reason, the policy of those holding us or the actions of those holding us were to keep us isolated from news of the outside. I felt perhaps they felt we would be more malleable or more manipulatable because of that.
Okay. So the day comes and you're ready to go. I mean, did this come as a huge shock the day that you were released? Had you lost hope about being released?
No, we never lost hope. There had been some false signs before that things might change. So you didn't deliberately get your hopes up too high because you knew that something could go wrong, there could be a problem. But there were two major indications that something major was going on. One was the visit approximately a month before we were released by an Algerian mediation team. There was an official from the Algerian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and then the Algerian ambassador in Tehran who came around, visited us, and told us in general terms what was going on, not specifics, not who was saying what or who was bargaining what. But this was certainly a very positive sign. It was the most positive sign that we had seen in a long time because these were serious people. And the fact that they had visited us, the students who were holding us either allowed them to do it or were forced to allow them to do it and had no choice. And so the sign was something serious is in the works and there looks like a change going on. Put that together with the change of administration in the United States and there was reason for hope.
I'm speaking with Ambassador John Limbert, who was one of the 52 Americans taken hostage at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979. We'll talk about his desire to return to Iran right after this short break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest, Ambassador John Limbert, was one of 52 Americans held captive in Iran from 1979 to 1981. So clearly since that time and your release, I mean, you've gone on to have a significant career in the Foreign Service and particularly throughout other parts of the region in the Middle East. How was that for you to return back to the region? And have you ever made it back to Iran?
I've never been back to Iran since that. This is not my choice. I would like to go back. I would like to take our children back because they were both born there. Would like to take our grandchildren back there because it's part of them. But so far, I'm not welcome.
And that's meaning not welcome
by the Iranians.
You would not be welcome there because of that.
That's right. Yeah. American tourists go. American visitors go.
So there's no prohibition for you to go from our perspective.
No,
from the U.S.
There's no thing. I'm a private citizen. I don't work for the State Department anymore. So there's no prohibition on it. Why this is so, I don't know. I think I remind them of a chapter in their past they would probably like to bury. And I wouldn't let them do that if I were there. I would be a walking reminder, forcing them to confront something that they would prefer not to. In terms of my career, I went back to working in the Foreign Service because it's what I do. It's what I know. And the experience reinforced the idea that this is important, that diplomacy is important, that talking among states is important, because during those 14 months, we had all witnessed firsthand the alternative, that when communication breaks down, the alternative, frankly, is anarchy, violence, and lawlessness. Now, the international arena, the stage for international relations, is already a pretty chaotic place in the best of circumstances. But when you remove every vestige of order and rule, then what are you left with? You're left with a kind of very, I call it Hobbesian universe, in which only the strong survive, and there is nothing to protect anyone else. It's ironic, really, that during all this, the Iranians kept saying that they didn't care about international law. They didn't care about international organizations, international structures. But those structures are there to protect the smaller countries. Presumably, the superpowers, the large powers, don't need them quite as much. It's countries like Iran that, in fact, need that kind of protection.
So it only hurts them to not participate in international organizations and abide by international law.
Well, the whole incident was for Iran and Iranians was incredibly self-destructive. I mean, you start to catalog, but just one example was the Iran-Iraq War. Saddam looked at Iran. He saw this country that was isolated, that was in turmoil, that was tearing itself apart. And correctly, he estimated that when he attacked, no one or almost no one in the international community would take Iran's side.
So critical mistake made by Iran.
Well, if they were thinking that way. I mean,
strategic mistake.
That's right. We don't live in a rational world. I wish we did, but we pretend we do sometimes. But we don't. And these were not decisions taken on the basis of a measured consideration of national interest.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about your passion now. I mean, obviously that experience, the passion that you have for diplomacy and open channels of communication and working together in that respect. So let's fast forward to today. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, after this crisis, damaged relations, Iran-U.S. relations, you know, have pretty much been non-existent since that time. But where are we headed today? I mean, as a diplomat, do you see that there's some hope for normalized relations now, particularly in light of a change of regime in Iran? Is the U.S. now more interested in redeveloping those ties? Where do you think we're headed today?
As a diplomat, my profession demands that I always be an optimist, that I always see something better out there. If you're not an optimist, you're probably in the wrong field. You shouldn't be in this field. You should be in something else. The fact of the matter is that for 34 years, the U.S. and Iran barely talked to each other. And if we did talk to each other, it was usually yelling at each other or calling each other names, insulting each other, threatening each other, sometimes worse than that. Where are we headed? Well, clearly something is changing. After the election of Hassan Rouhani in Iran, the Iranians have undertaken a new direction. The election of Barack Obama in 2008 set the United States in a new direction, where President Obama used language and styles toward Iran that had not been heard in a long time. For 5 years, however, there was not a positive response to that. And so what you have now is a coincidence, call it a fortunate coincidence, of two leaders who seem to have some common features in their vision of the relationship. Until now, you haven't had that. You had – if one side seemed interested in changing the relationship, doing – making some progress, the other side pulled back. It could have been bad luck, bad coincidence, bad timing, whatever it was. When under President Clinton, when the U.S. reached out in 1997, 1998, the Iranians pulled back. In 2003, the Iranians came forward with a plan. The Bush administration wasn't interested. Now, and in 2009. President Obama came forward with his ideas. The Iranians were not very responsive. Now you have a situation where it's possible that the two sides could actually talk, could come together at the same time. Because after all, President Obama 5 years ago spoke about engagement based on mutual interest and mutual respect, something that the Iranians had always said they wanted. 5 years later, President Rouhani is now talking about moderation. Even the Supreme Leader is talking about flexibility. This is new in the political vocabulary. And so you have a coincidence of leadership with certainly not the same vision, but at least similarities in their visions of how this relationship might go.
So potentially not opening the door for a better future laying ahead, I suppose. That's the optimistic view.
Well, what we have is maybe the door isn't open. Maybe the window isn't open, but maybe there's a small crack in this wall of mistrust and suspicion and hostility that's divided us for over three decades.
Well, it certainly will be interesting to see how this develops and how this kind of, you know, coming together and the timing of these two leaders at one time might play out. Well, thank you, Ambassador Limbert, for sharing your story with us today. It's very inspiring, and I appreciate you being here to share this with us.
Well, thank you, Suzette. My pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ambassador John Limbert, a longtime diplomat who was held captive in Iran during the 1979 hostage crisis. Monday marks 33 years since Limbert and 51 other Americans were set free. During the ordeal, Limbert met with the future Supreme Leader, and we have that video on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview, and Brian Hartzinski edits the program and produces our digital content. We'll be back in Oklahoma next week. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.